Guns, Geithner, and job growth. We'll tackle those and other top stories in the news on The Week in Review. Rob Ferret here, filling in for Joy Cardine. It's Friday, January 11th, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's say hi to our guests. Chris Lotto is former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, good morning. Happy New Year, Rob.
And then in the studio here is Joe Winicky, former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Hello, Joe.
Well, hello, Rob.
Let me turn your microphone.
How about that? Hello, Rob.
Just for old time's sake.
That's right. And hello, Chris. Well, I came in here to get the advantage, you know, of being of having a microphone that worked.
Well, I gave you a handicap for that.
That's okay.
You'll have
appreciate
to talk to your
that,
mom.
Rob. Thank you.
Not a problem.
Well, let's jump right in. I think probably the top story this week is guns. Vice President Joe Biden has been meeting with people all over the place on gun issues, victims groups, gun control groups, and the NRA. And the meeting with the NRA didn't go so well. The NRA says they don't see a lot that the White House might do about guns that they're going to agree with. Are you surprised, starting with Joe Winicky?
No, Wayne LaPierre is an idiot. I think Stephen Colbert hit it best, if for any listeners that saw him the other day. It was just absolutely hilarious, his parody of the NRA. At some point, these guys got to understand that arming the masses with Bushmaster AR-15s is not the way to safety. And I'm just so sick of legislators in both political parties, in Congress, in the legislature, and everything else, that will not stand up to bullies. And the NRA has become a bully.
Chris Lotto, is the NRA a bully when it comes to gun control?
Well, you know, it's interesting, the report that was out this week that the NRA is claiming that its membership actually spiked by 100,000 people in the midst of all this controversy and discussion of how the administration is going to go after gun ownership and what exactly they're going to target, no pun intended. I think they said they're up to, you know, 4.2 million. I think that the real concern for a lot of folks out there, not just NRA, is that the administration really is strongly anti-Second Amendment, and they're looking for an excuse to put those beliefs into action. And
where's your proof of that, Chris?
The horrible Sandy Hook, you know, shootings really give them a political opening here.
Where's the proof of that?
Let me finish my point. Now, I think that the problem is, and Joe alluded to this, and he's right, is whether there is ultimately the political wherewithal to do much of anything. And he's right to note that, you know, politicians in both parties, a lot of them have A's from the NRA rating book. And the real danger here is that there may be some things that the administration can do, and there may be some policy that the administration can push forward that, you know, reasonable people on both sides can embrace. The question is, are they going to propose that, you know, a reasonable amount of legislation that everybody can get behind, or are they going to overreach?
Well,
we don't know that yet. I mean, we don't know. We're hearing a lot of rumbling from Joe Biden about, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do the other thing. And the fact is, if they put together too big a package of stuff that is not palatable to those who, you know, who are NRA supporters and NRA supported, then maybe nothing's going to happen, or very little.
To the listeners, if you want to jump in on the gun issue, do it quickly at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Also, if you have thoughts on a cabinet shuffle going on, we're going to get to that in a few minutes, 800-642-1234. Well, you mentioned Joe Biden talking about what might happen in the near future. One of the things on the table is possible executive action are requiring universal, I believe, background checks for gun purchases. Chris, let's start with you. Is that, you mentioned the idea that maybe there's some reasonable middle ground. Is that it?
There's been talk about focusing on the gun database and whether that's a good idea. You know, I'll be honest, for me personally, that doesn't seem like an unreasonable thing to do. I would imagine that there are a lot of folks out there who are concerned about the government sort of overreaching and gathering, you know, information that they shouldn't, that they're going to use it for purposes that, you know, they shouldn't be using it for. There's, an invasion of privacy component here when the government's pulling too much information, that law-abiding citizens are being put into a more punitive situation as the result of a lone nut, frankly. So, to me, it doesn't seem unreasonable, but I understand that there are objections out there, and I understand where those folks are coming from.
Joe?
Well, I wish it was a lone nut. Well, yesterday there was another school shooting. what didn't have the same catastrophe, but a principal was hurt, a student was hurt, and the kid's in custody. This happens all the time. And I'm still waiting for the... Chris, where in the first term of the Obama administration were they anti-gun?
When I'm referring to is I think what we're going to see out of the administration in the coming weeks, that... You know, frankly, they had too much other stuff going on to make guns a priority. They know it's a hot-button issue. And now, look, Joe, for you to say, to deny that, oh, yeah, there's a political opportunity presented by these recent shootings that they can push forward an agenda that some see as anti-Second Amendment, you know, I mean, come on, you know. You were in politics. You were in the state senate. You know how these things work.
For a well-regulated militia means you should have machine guns.
Hold on, Joe.
As a result of the Sandy Hook shootings. That's my point.
I'm very passionate about this. I just think that there is something wrong with our society and our government when the NRA and its 4.2 million current members, because I suspect they'll be losing some. You know, rational members over those crazy actions where they say, we ought to have a national database of the mentally ill, but we shouldn't have a national database of gun ownership.
I want to bring in a couple callers back to back on this issue. We've got Chris on the line in Oshkosh. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, good morning.
What did you have to say?
Good morning, guys. Hey, Joe, this is really addressed to you because I think I understand that I can prejudge Chris's opinion in the same way that he judges the president's. But the NRA started out as a sportsman's organization.
Yes, it did.
It was supportive of the rights of individuals, but over the years, in my opinion, it has changed into basically becoming a manufacturer's lobby. When I talk to NRA members on the street, almost all of them, with the most doctrinaire, agree that we should limit certain things, automatic, semi-automatic, large volume clips, gun show loopholes, et cetera, et cetera. And yet their leader, Mr. LaPierre, opposes all of this. What's your take on that, please?
I think you're 100% correct, and you are also very correct about the history of the NRA, which as late as the Eisenhower administration had nothing to do with the crazies that were out there.
And Chris, I won't prejudge your answer to that. What do you have to say?
Well, I appreciate it. Chris, I still respect his opinion, even though he's wrong. Has the NRA changed over time? Obviously it has. And it's become more, encased in what I think would be considered far-right beliefs. Because, again, I think some of these folks in the vast middle would consider that some of these proposals that will likely be floated, we don't know exactly what's coming, but we've seen hints of what might be proposed, they're reasonable. They're not unreasonable requests. And I think the NRA has kind of, in more recent times, backed itself into a corner by taking positions that a lot of folks do find extreme. They have left no middle ground on anything. And, you know, perhaps some good will come of this, and perhaps we will see some of the loopholes being closed, and perhaps we will see some of the laws that are already on the books get better enforced by the federal government. And that is not a bad thing. I don't want anybody to get me wrong here about where I'm coming from. But the point is that, the administration can do some things that I think reasonable people would agree are the smart thing to do. But there is a legitimate, I think, concern out there that they're going to reach too far. And if they do reach too far, they're going to have tough sledding in Congress, and they will not be able to get done what they think they can.
And I would argue, Chris, that the NRA has reached too far. Not only are they completely oblivious to the public mood, but they have become a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party. 99% of their contributions go to Republicans. Even as late as 2004, I believe it was, when Rod Mohn, who was a state senator and friend of mine from central Wisconsin up there in western part between La Crosse and Eau Claire area, had an A rating with the NRA over his whole career. Rod will understand when I say this. He kind of just did what he had to do to keep their rating. When he had a candidate who had never run for office before, the other guy got the endorsement. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think you'd agree, Joe, that there are a lot of, you mentioned Republicans and the NRA supports Republicans. There are plenty of Democrats in Congress as well who are not going to be very particularly warm to whatever the administration proposes. There are a number of pro-gun Democrats that are not going to support some of this stuff.
I'm a pro-gun Democrat. I'm a pro-gun Democrat, but I don't think you should have Uzis in schools.
Well, let's. I want to bring another call in before we move on from the issue. Randy in Kewaskum is with us. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. You know, when you talk about overreaching, I've read Dianne Feinstein's bill that the left is touting, and basically the way that is written, that gives them the right to ban anything and everything beyond the 120 guns that are specifically listed as banned, including such sporting rifles as the Ruger Mini 14 and Mini 30 that are just on there because they have a detachable magazine. There's wording in there that says any gun that has been used by law enforcement or the military cannot be considered a sporting arm. Well, that would include pretty much everything that's left. Bolt-action rifles, including the Remington and Winchester, which have been used by the military as sniper rifles, and everything's based on a military German 98 action.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Randy. I want to get a response from the guest before we move on. There's an example. Somebody concerned that what might look like an innocuous middle ground step to some might be an overreach, might outlaw a lot of guns that people use for good legitimate reasons, Joe.
This is what always happens. They take a sentence in a proposal and twist it or in their own mind, read it, to be fair to the caller, in a way that others may not read it. I mean, just this week, Stanley McChrystal, who I would argue is no friend of the president since he had to sack him, came out and said there's no reason for military-style weapons to be used by the citizenry. So, you know, and for, the second thing is I don't even think the Obama administration is going to propose an assault weapon ban, even though they should.
Chris, last word on guns before we move on?
Well, I mean, Randy has a point that I think articulates what I've been trying to say here is that, you know, there is a concern out there that there will be legislation proposed that does overreach, that does things that frankly I would think even Joe would agree it shouldn't do, that would ban weapons that really, you know, should be accessible, you know, legally of course, but should be available to folks. And you know, whether it's an irrational fear that the Obama administration is going to take your guns away, which, you know, at the other extreme, I would argue is, you know, I don't think that is their goal. But there is a concern out there that any kind of legislation is going to be, an overreach. And I think what to Randy's point, it's a question of, you know, those who want to see gun ownership continue and remain legal in the United States for a certain type of weapons just need to be watching this stuff closely. And the administration needs to be aware that they're, of course, going to be watched very closely with anything they propose.
Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine, talking to Joe Winicky and Chris Lotto on this edition of the Week in Review. We're going to move on from guns. That issue won't get resolved this hour or probably in the next few months or maybe years. Big news this week in President Obama's cabinet, a lot of reshuffling for the second term. Some of the freshest news, Timothy Geithner on the way out, and he has a new appointee, Jack Lew, for the Treasury Department. Supposedly he got a lot of history with the Clinton administration, not supposedly he does, and a lot of background in negotiating budgets. Your thoughts, start with you, Joe Winicky.
Oh, I think it's a good choice. I always believe whether it's Scott Walker, whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's any chief executive officer ought to be able to put their people in charge of their programs. And in the case of Mr. Lew, outside of the fact that it's the craziest signature I've ever seen, and I saw the president make light of that yesterday and said that at least one letter has to be legible on that piece of paper he'll be signing. Is that this guy is a tough negotiator. He's a budget hawk, but he also believes in protecting those in society that need help the most. And I think that's where the president comes from, and he ought to have a right to push his own agenda. I don't know why Democrats or Republicans generally oppose any of these. I didn't oppose any of Scott Walker's appointees, for example, even though I disagree with some of them, because, you know, winning an election has consequences, and those consequences should allow a person to put in the people, male, female, red, white, green, black, orange, yellow, straight, gay, who cares, that they want.
Chris, some Republicans in Congress, I'm thinking of Senator Sessions in particular, have expressed concerns about the possibility of this Treasury Secretary being confirmed, that he is too intransigent a negotiator. He won't give in. He won't budge. Are you worried about that?
Well, I mean, he does have something of a history. I think just an objective look at his record, you would say, okay, he's qualified to do the job, right? But I think, you know, he's in the middle of these fights over raising the debt ceiling, avoiding the fiscal cliff. A fair number of Republicans see him as somebody who is really not very interested in Republican views, you know, to the point that he might not even recognize where there are some areas that the GOP might be willing to compromise on things, you know. He's been dug in on defending the administration's policies. His personality and his style of discussion and negotiation, due to, you know, with after some widespread reports, indicates that you know, Republicans are a little concerned that you know, he's not going to be somebody who's easy to work with. And let's face it, these are issues that are coming to a head in the coming months that are going to be extraordinarily difficult under the best of circumstances to work through for both sides. This is going to be a challenging time. And the question, I think, on the minds of a lot of Republicans is, do we want to pick somebody who's going to be polarizing or is at least open to kind of working together? Now, all that said, you know, Joe Winnicke's right. You know, there's that school of thought that the president should be able to pick his team. I mean, with ultimately no opposition. I mean, you're going to, you know, put him on the hot seat. You're going to question him. You're going to question his record. You're going to question his style and everything else. But ultimately, the president gets what he wants. And we always go through this with two-term presidents. After the first term, there's a lot of shuffling of the deck chairs. And, you know, again, you know, the shoe's on the other foot. Republicans would be making the same case. Hey, let the president have what, you know, what he wants in his cabinet. He deserves that opportunity. So I get that school of thought, and I don't necessarily disagree with it.
Jack Lew is actually, I would argue, not he's going to fly through here. The more fascinating appointment is Chuck Hagel's, which seems to have left and right and everybody else upset, which tells me he must be a good pick.
Or a really bad one if somebody from everywhere dislikes him. This is Hagel.
But nobody
let me set the stage, Joe. Chuck
nobody
Hagel,
thinks he's incompetent.
Wait. Nominated for defense secretary this week by President Obama. Want to lay out the substructure here before we get into the details. But yeah, he's been under fire from some of his former Republican Senate colleagues, worried about his commitment to Israel and his opposition to Iran not being firm enough. But yeah, there's been criticism over remarks he made about, I believe, as an openly gay ambassador appointee some years ago. So now, Joe, go ahead.
I probably said something stupid 15 years ago, too.
So do you think he's going to end up being appointed?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I think the real reason he's being appointed has nothing to do with issues of sexuality. It has nothing to do with Israel. I think it has to do with the fact that we have about a $16 trillion budget deficit, and all items are going to be on the table, including defense. And I think this is a person who understands the defense industry and will be willing to make tough decisions. I think it sent a signal, a very strong signal, that the public, or that the president, is going to do some cutting of spending in this budget, and he needs his people around him. I think that's why Jack Lew's in place. I think that's why Chuck Hagel was picked.
Chris Lotto, your thoughts on Chuck Hagel?
Well, the Hagel point, the Hagel choice is an interesting one. And going back to Joe's point, I have a hard time believing that any one of these will ultimately be rejected unless we see something emerge that is so incendiary that it buries it. Based on all the information we have in hand right now, it doesn't seem like anybody is in danger of not being confirmed. Now, in particular on Hagel, Rob, you mentioned the Iran and Israel positions and past things that he said, and the third point is defense spending. And it seems, based on comments from, I think, a couple of years ago, maybe a little less than that, that he would advocate the kind of automatic cuts in the Pentagon that even Leon Panetta said would gut the Pentagon. And you know, if you have, you know, Leon Panetta expressing that concern that Hagel wants to really cut deep into the Pentagon, that should be a cause for concern for Congress. You know, the other point to make is Hagel does not reflect bipartisanship on Obama's part. You know, the Washington Post had an editorial last month, and they made the point, you know, based on some of these positions that Hagel is taking, he's to the left even of President Obama and where Obama was in his first term. And that means that, you know, Hagel's not just on the fringe. He is on the fringe, rather. He's nowhere near the mainstream. So I certainly think some members of Congress who have already been making that clear are going to have a real problem with the nomination. But do I ultimately think he'll be confirmed? Yeah, I think he will.
One more cabinet appointee before we move on to a late break. President Obama is also nominating Homeland Security Advisor John Brennan to head up the CIA. President Obama says he's a skilled, respected intelligence professional. But Lindsey Graham, Republican in the Senate, says delay the confirmation until we get more answers on the Benghazi consulate attacks on September 11th. Chris, should they hold off on confirming until they get the answers that they're looking for?
I think they're using it as leverage, and I think it's a smart thing to do. Again, I don't sense the fire here or the wherewithal to block this confirmation from going through. But Senator Graham obviously sees an opportunity to get some answers from an administration that has not been totally shooting straight on what happened in Libya. And I think he should do that. I think we do deserve those answers. I think, you know, the other thing that's interesting about this one, about Brennan, is, you know, John McCain's opposition because of Brennan's apparent support and defense of enhanced interrogation techniques, you know, waterboarding included there. You know, he's going to face some tough questions. He's eventually going to be in the hot seat and is going to have to talk through and explain himself clearly to the members of the panel and the American people at large. But he'll have to be prepared for that. But I, again, don't think it'll stop him from being confirmed ultimately.
Defeat often makes people bitter. And John McCain and his puppet Lindsey Graham have continually tried to put a knife in every single thing that this president does. I used to respect both of these senators. I thought they were moderate. I thought they would occasionally go outside the box. But I don't see that anymore. And in John Brennan's case, I don't know enough about him to say yay or nay, but I know he was the president's counterterrorism chief. I mean, the left doesn't like him because of the drone attacks. The right doesn't like him because he's with the president. Once again, it tells me he's probably well qualified to do the job.
But Joe, for your criticism of, you know, where Graham and McCain are at, particularly on this one, do you actually think that ultimately they're going to do anything to stand in the way of this confirmation?
No, I don't.
I mean, it's politics, right?
I think it's all politics.
That's Chris Lotto and Joe Winicky, our guests this week for The Week in Review. Joe Winicky and Chris Lotto joining us for The Week in Review. We'll get to state issues coming up in a bit, and I'd like to hear your calls at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. One of the questions I'll be asking, do Republicans have a mandate to do just about whatever they want in this legislative session? 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@WPR.org. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next Monday at 7, it's the State Capitol Report. Joy Cardine will be back, and she'll talk to WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson about some of the state issues we're talking about now, and they'll probably preview Governor Walker's State of the State address. Right now, it's the Week in Review. Joe Winicky is here with me. Chris Lotto is on the phone. We're hitting some of the news of the week. We're going to get to state issues in just a moment, but Mark in Middleton has a question on the cabinet appointments issue. Mark, you're on the air.
No, thank you. Good morning. I'm a little concerned. I agree that the president should have the ability to select his cabinet members, but with respect to Jack Lew and the comment that he probably won't have any trouble being confirmed for the position, I have to ask a question in a cynical sense. What is his position with respect to Wall Street regulation and attempts to try and crack down on the banking industry and perhaps even break up the large banks? It seems that he may be more of a friend of Wall Street than what we need right now, particularly in light of what happened in 2008 and the need to straighten out the markets.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Joe, quick thought on that?
Well, he can't be worse than Geithner when it comes to Wall Street. I think the fact that he spent a brief amount of time there is not a disqualifier. I frankly do not understand why my party, the Democratic Party, has not been harder on clear misuse of people's money by AIG, by the Wall Street banks. And yes, many of them have had to pay multi-billion-dollar fines. But, you know, when you're making billions and billions and billions of dollars, and that's what gets you off, and nothing has changed. I mean, you know, in the 30s, when we, you know, Roosevelt closed the banks. At some point, we've got to get back to a regulatory climate that's fair to the business community, but also protects the citizens. We don't have that today.
Chris, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I've seen the reports about that come up and suggesting that, you know, Lou might be a little cozier with Wall Street than certainly I would think a lot of Democrats would feel comfortable with. But again, as Joe points out, Geithner was, you know, fairly chummy with them as well. So, are we trading one pal of Wall Street for another here? I don't know that Lou's record is as strong as Geithner's was in terms of being a pal of Wall Street, but that is definitely an issue that's out there. I don't think that it's enough baked into his past to again derail the nomination. But again, you know, you rise to a certain level in government, and you're going to have a hard time finding somebody who doesn't have ties to Wall Street. The question is, you know, not only their history, but what are they going to do from here? And to Joe's point, I'm not sure that this administration, believe it or not, has the wherewithal to really crack down on Wall Street.
Joe mentioned AIG. Just want to get your quick thoughts there. AIG running thank you ads, recovering from the bailout, and then apparently considering joining a lawsuit against the federal government for how they handled the bailout. Some bad publicity there. They have said they will not join that lawsuit. Just a quick hit on that, Joe?
Well, I mean, for the Razzie Awards for stupidity, Wayne LaPierre gets number one, but AIG gets number two. How can you have the audacity to spend millions of dollars saying, thank you, America, and then threaten to sue the United States government because you were too hard on them?
Chris?
Yeah, the first thought that came to mind is AIG has a PR campaign of thank you, America, and then they filed a lawsuit, and it would basically be up yours, America. So, I think cooler heads prevailed, and they realized whatever merits they thought they had in joining that lawsuit, they made a wise move, because I think the outcry and the tsunami of outrage that the American people and Congress would display if AIG were to join that suit, probably would have, dinged their reputation to an irreparable degree.
Hey, Chris, this was one area where it was bipartisan.
Everybody
thought AIG was nuts.
Hey, halfway through, we finally came together.
Not just us. I'm talking about Republicans in Congress, Democrats in Congress.
That's right. And I mean, yeah, it is outrageous. I mean, when you think about, taxpayers bail them out to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, and you
hundreds.
Have them running this cynical campaign that says, thank you, America, at the same time they're thinking, which my understanding is they had to consider it, but they obviously made the right choice by not doing it. Yeah, that's going to raise a few hackles, I think.
Talking to Joe Winicky, former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Chris Lotto, former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. It's the Week in Review. We're going to bring things home now to Wisconsin. Let's talk dress codes here. Apparently new rules in the state assembly say guys suit jacket or a jacket anyway when you're out on the floor. And hey, if you're up in the gallery, you can't wear a hat, you can't eat up there, you can't use a cell phone. Joe Winicky, you were wearing a tie-dyed t-shirt from UW-River Falls with a donkey on it.
And a Mallard's hat.
I don't think you'd be allowed there.
I would not be allowed there. And to my friend Ben Plunkett and all the UW-River Falls Democrats, that shirt's still on 4 years later. But
you've washed it, I hope.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it shrunk a little, or I gained. I can't remember. My friend John Antaramian, the former assembly member and mayor of Kenosha, is really got to be upset today because he never wore a tie in his life, I swear, when he was in the assembly. Didn't like him, didn't want him. This is something I expect from the state senate, which I served in, as well as the assembly. And the state senate, it's the College of Cardinals, and they call each other senator, sniff, sniff. And they do have a dress code. You have to have a coat and a tie, and women could not wear hats until Gwen Moore, our congresswoman, got the rule changed. Now the assembly is going to do the same thing, and I think it's a bad call. Not that, people shouldn't dress appropriately, but, in a day where you can't go into a Boston store or a Penny's and buy a suit because all they have are separates, it seems kind of silly that in the time when we're moving into a more casual lifestyle, that now we're going to have this autocratic dress code. And it reminds me of the same thing with the rules in the parlor. One time I was in the state senate when the NRA was passing another one of their crazy gun bills, and everybody in the gallery was wearing blaze orange. It didn't offend me. I wasn't afraid. Now, of course, they can also carry guns in there, but they can't carry a cell phone. That might have made me a little more afraid. But the point is that it is still, the assembly was always the people's house. It's an amalgamation of things. And what's going on here is the creation of an autocracy, I guess because they're afraid of Segway Jeremy?
Chris?
Well, I'm glad to hear Joe's take on this first, because that was my first thought. And my second was, you know, all this debate this week makes an incredibly strong case for converting to a part-time legislature.
I agree.
Time to talk about this. My God. So, it's pretty clear that legislators have way too much time on their hands when they're talking about, you know, what I would consider, and I would imagine a lot of people in the state consider, really these petty battles over legislative operation rules and whether you should be wearing a coat and tie to, you know, to session. And, you know, they did take up some interesting stuff that I think had merit. You know, for example, late night voting. I think that's something where obviously both sides could come together and agree that, look, you're passing bills in the middle of the night. It feeds into the perception that, you know, you're doing things you shouldn't be doing in the legislature. And I think it was wise to look at ways to change that. But on some of this other stuff, it's like, really? This is how you're going to kick things off? I mean, you know, we've got an economic situation in the state that could use a little attention, and we got to start getting some jobs back. And you guys are worried about whether, you know, Joe Blow from Superior is going to be wearing a tie to, you know, to the legislative session. I think priorities are a little out of whack here, and hopefully they get back on course soon.
We'll move off the style pages now and get into a question I asked earlier. Tim will start us off on the issue of whether Republicans have a mandate to do whatever they want. Tim in Grand Rapids is with us. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I heard you guys talk about mandate a while ago, and I really want to point out that in Wisconsin, and I don't have the exact data, but I think approximately people voted about 55% Democrat in the last election, and as with the gerrymandering from the Republicans controlling all three branches of government, they win an overwhelming majority of the assembly seats. So I guess, and I see this going on in every state across the union. So at the federal level as well, you have more Republican congressmen and perhaps people voting more Democrat, yet they're more Republican. So when you say that you have the numbers and I represent my district and I got to do this or I got to do that, regardless of what the president wants, do you have a mandate because you have the numbers in the assembly or in the Congress?
Gotcha. Thanks, Tim. Let's start with you, Chris. We've got the case. The governor won his recall. Republicans won both houses, but Democrats are making the case that Tim just did, that they won the legislature because of gerrymandering.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, I think there are some sour grapes there, but as Joe pointed out on the national level a short time ago, and I'm going to steal that argument now, elections have consequences, and we have a wholly Republican-managed legislature, and we have a governor who beat back a Democrat challenge last year to come back stronger than ever. What they have now is a mandate to address, you know, the most important issues that are out there, not dress codes, but the economic issues that we need to start looking at and paying serious attention to create jobs in this state and to get the economy moving in a way that it really hasn't been, frankly, in Wisconsin. So Republicans do have a mandate. They have a mandate to get serious and start working on these things. So, you know, I understand, you know, it's a tough pill to swallow, but Republicans, you know, handily won these races, and they are now in control, for better or for worse.
We'll get into those economic and job issues coming up in a bit. But, Joe, they won. They won, re-won the governor's office. They won both houses. Do they even have to worry about what Democrats have to say?
No. I mean, in a nutshell, elections do have consequences. And the election that really had consequences relating to this was the 2010 election, where Democrats were kind of ambivalent and stayed home, and the Republicans were just wild about Obamacare and all this other stuff. And what nobody was voting on in 2010 was the fact that in 2011, every state in the country was going to redistrict. And what happened was 700 legislative seats shifted from Democrat to Republican in the 2010 elections. They won control of a bunch of chambers. And with the increased technology that's now available, we're able to do some fascinating things with gerrymandering. Saying that, the Democrats probably would have done the same thing. That's why I'm a complete proponent of taking redistricting out of the hands of the legislature. Now, the one thing, and I'm going to parrot Chris this time, is that be careful of how far you go. You know, when we started the gun conversation, it was, you know, there are reasonable things can be done, but don't go too far. I would argue the same thing about this legislature. The governor's already sending signals that he doesn't want a contentious 2 years because he wants to get reelected. I don't trust this assembly as far as I could throw it when it comes to anything moderate. I think they're going to do all kinds of wacko things.
Well, you know, and Joe knows this as well as anybody. It's a question of watch what they do, not what they say. And,
right.
And the governor has obviously been making, you know, statements about, you know, let's be more moderate, let's work together, let's find areas of common ground. But, you know, we'll get a much clearer picture in the coming weeks of how serious he takes that. And look, let's be honest. I mean, you know, short of taking a Democrat bill and calling it his own, no matter what the governor puts out there is going to be, you know, taken to task by a fair number of Democrats. They're not going to be kind to anything that he lays out there, and we're starting to see little drips and drabs of what he's going to propose.
I'm interested in one thing, and I'm very serious about this. I think the real first issue on the table is the mining bill. And if this is going to be an interesting test to see if the governor and the legislature are willing to look at a bipartisan bill, because Senator Cullen came up with, I think, a fairly rational bill. It may not be everything the mining company wants or the WMC wants, but if they add, you know, a couple of things that Senator Cullen proposed, then I think they're speaking the truth. If they just ram that through, I think it's the same old, same old.
Well, and I think you need, you know, when you talk about Senator Cullen, you need people on both sides that are actually serious about working something out, and not just folks who are posing and say they want to be at the table, but they really have zero interest in working anything out related to mining. And I think you've got to weed those folks out and say, okay, are you serious and do you want to work on something, or do you just want to make noise? And I think that'll be telling. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be the first fight that probably, to a certain extent, defines what this session is going to be like. I mean, much more so than dress codes and late night votes. I mean, this is one of those issues that died off for a while and now it's been resurrected. So, this will be very telling about how the next couple of years are going to go.
Agreed. We're hearing from Joe Winicky and Chris Lotto in this edition of The Week in Review. I think maybe a bit more on mining when we come back, the Week in Review quiz, and the jobs picture in Wisconsin, looking at a new federal census of jobs in the state. That doesn't show great numbers. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. I'm Rob Verrett, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Verrett filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight on Here and Now on Wisconsin Public Television, host Frederica Freiberg goes one-on-one with incumbent state Supreme Court candidate Pat Rogensack. Plus, a look at the first week of action at the state capitol. That's Here and Now tonight at 7:30 on Wisconsin Public Television. And congratulations, guys, on your 10-year anniversary on Here and Now. Well done. It's the Week in Review. I've got Chris Lotto on the phone, Joe Winicky in the studio. We're talking about the top stories of the week. Here's our quiz question. Hasbro, the game company, is creating some waves this week regarding one of its classic board games. I'm a big board game fan. It's going to get rid of one of the game's 8 iconic playing pieces and introduce a more modern token. Joe's shaking his head. Which game are we talking about? Don't answer, Joe. You can answer at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll give you 5 or 8 minutes or so to do that. We have a call on mining, which we were talking about just before the break. Steven is with us in Oconomowoc. Hi, Steven.
Hi.
What did you have to say about mining?
Well, I think that we're not looking at it the way we should. It's iron ore has skyrocketed, and last year when they started this mining bill, they were going to put a $2 tax in, and the Republicans went nuts. $2 on a ton of iron ore now is nothing. Iron ore is $170, $180 a ton with huge spikes. It's not like our grandfathers when it was $12 a ton straight across the board for 30 years. As India and China supplies and demand switches every month, these things go way too high, and we're not taxing enough of it.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Stephen. Joe, if an iron mine happens, are we going to get enough of a taste in the state government?
No. And the other thing is, the real issue to me, yes, we should try and get some revenues off this, and those dollars should be sent back to the local communities that are affected by these mines. The issue that has to be addressed if there's going to be any sort of bipartisan mining bill is groundwater. Is this mine going to affect Lake Superior, the largest freshwater lake in the world? Is this mining bill going to affect the rivers and streams that go into the Bad River Indian Reservation? There's a lot of things I have to deal with, but the one thing we should always remember is we should do no harm. If we can find a way to extricate $170 a ton ore in a safe way, go for it. I mean, mining's on our state flag, but if we can't, you don't do it.
Chris?
Well, I mean, partially to Joe's point, but also to kind of reiterate something I said earlier. I mean, I think it's important for folks to be honest and upfront about what their intentions are regarding the mining bill. And that goes for all the interest groups that are going to get involved and everybody else. And I know that's asking for a lot, and we're probably not going to see it. But certainly it can start with the legislature being upfront and clear about, do they really support mining? Do they support it at all, first of all? Let's start with that. And once they do, be honest about what you want to see in this bill. And if you don't support mining, be upfront about that. Because this is an issue that is going to get contentious and it's going to get ugly. There are a host of environmental, economic concerns. I mean, this is one of the big ones that has the potential to get very ugly very fast. And I just think it's important for those in the legislature and those that are going to be working on this bill for a change to just be upfront with folks and tell them where they're at going in. And if they're open to the possibility, what's it going to take? And let's start working through these issues instead of right away, jumping straight to the posturing. I think that will help, and I think that would set a tone for the rest of the legislative session that might lead to something productive.
A lot of people making the case for jobs in that mining bill. Some other job news in the state this week. The quarterly census of jobs for the nation ranked Wisconsin 42nd in job creation, last in the Midwest. We're seeing a 1.5% increase in the number of private sector jobs. That's from June 2011 to June 2012. Takes them a while to collate those numbers. Why is this? Is this bad news? Joe Wienicke, why don't we start with you?
Well, to quote the governor, it's all because of the recall.
We heard that in the news this morning.
Unbelievable. He can only use that dog don't hunt. He's eventually got to come up with a new excuse. But knowing how the governor operated during the recall, he'll just make up new numbers anyway.
Well, but the timing matches up, doesn't it? He was saying job creation is slow because of this recall election. These numbers really end right around the time of the recall election. He says, hey, let's watch for the next set of numbers.
Maybe it's because his policies aren't working. There's a concept.
Chris, what do you think?
Well, Joe is quick to dismiss what the governor is saying out of hand, and yes. I wouldn't be so quick to do that. Well, of course. But I do think there's some merit to it. But that said, the governor did, to be fair, put a number out there that was a very ambitious number that he said he was gonna hit in his first term for job creation. And, look, I've said all along, and I've said it on this program before, I think it's fair for folks to hold him to that number. Can he achieve that goal of 250,000 jobs by the end of the first term? It's going to take some real growth, and the numbers that came out this week are not particularly encouraging. I mean, there are signs of improvement. The state's growth rate itself has improved recently, so that's encouraging. But, the clock is running out, and there's going to have to be a lot done in a short amount of time. Otherwise, the 250,000 jobs promise does become, to my mind, fair game. I believe that the governor is doing what he can. I think this term will really define that, and I think we will see some ambitious job creation and economic growth proposals coming from the administration as they have to do. It's not the greatest news, but I do think there is some merit to what the governor's saying here.
Let's do a little lightning round, a little shorter answers, because there's a little more ground I want to cover. One of the things that the governor has said is a priority, and Robin Voss, I know, he's said cutting income tax in Wisconsin, mainly for people in the $20,000 to $200,000 range, as part of an effort maybe to goose the economy, get a little more money in people's pockets, ultimately leading to more jobs. Chris, start with you on that one.
Yeah, it's the right approach to take, absolutely. He has a clear opportunity here, the governor does. He has the political winds at his back with a Republican-controlled legislature, and this is exactly the right sort of direction he should be taking things.
Joe?
Very few people in Wisconsin under $20,000 pay income taxes. The way our tax code is structured, very few people over $200,000 are affected in a real way. It's a nice thought. I would still argue until we can get our basic service structure back at the universities, health and human services, K-12 schools, it's premature. If down the road we have the money and he can do an income tax cut, fine.
Governor Walker says his executive budget is not going to contain plans for carpool toll lanes. There's been a lot of talk about how we're going to pay for roads now that our cars are getting so darn fuel efficient. Gas taxes aren't doing the trick. Do we need toll roads in Wisconsin, Joe?
I hate toll roads. and second, saying that, we have to come to grips with the transportation crisis. As fuel economy standards keep going up, we're supposed to be to, 54 miles a gallon at 225. That means there's less and less money coming into the transportation fund, and the cost of highways keeps going up because of the cost of oil. Chris?
Yeah, we're coming together here. I hate toll roads, too. I have one of those stupid boxes for, you know, tolls. Like when you drive through Illinois, you just could breeze through, and every time I look at it, it irks me a little bit that I have to have one of those in my car. Transportation is one of those key issues and a perpetually thorny one that's going to have to be part of the mix here in the coming couple of years and how those things are going to be funded. But I think he would have a lot of bipartisan support by saying, yeah, we're not going to do toll roads in this state.
State of the State address coming up on Tuesday night. As I mentioned, you can hear it right here on the Ideas Network, 7 o'clock. Shawn Johnson, Frederica Freiberg are going to anchor that. Governor Walker, as you guys mentioned, saying he's going to have a more moderate tone. What are you looking for, Joe, in the State of the State?
You rah-rah Scott Walker.
So cheerleading for his agenda?
Just as Tommy Thompson did, just as Jim Doyle did, just as all the others do. It's a State of the State address. It doesn't have any budget issues in it. It's a pep talk.
Chris?
Well, first of all, Rob, next time Joe sings, can you turn on the auto tune?
Oh, we have that. We can remix it and do amazing things.
I can't even sing in the shower.
the State of the State, much more than the budget, is kind of a ceremonial affair. Look how good I'm doing. And I'm sure he's going to be preaching bipartisanship because that's what you do. But obviously the real thing to watch is the budget and what comes from that.
Well, the really important thing to do is to listen Wednesday morning from 6 to 9. Joy Cardine will talk to a bunch of different guests about what the governor had to say and what might come out of that moving forward.
Bring Mike LaCrone in. Well, at least they can do on Wisconsin better.
Oh, they can sing it better, right, yeah. Troubling news, the flu, lots of it. The CDC says Milwaukee Hospital seeing lots of people coming in. You guys feeling any sniffles? Chris, I understand you were not feeling well a couple weeks ago.
I was supposed to do the show a couple weeks ago, and I did get the shot, but I think I still had the symptoms. And, you know, for a couple days, I was just wiped out. So I feel for folks who are dealing with it now, and it's reaching, you know, the proportions of an outbreak, you know, in most states in the U.S., and it's concerning. So I know from direct experience that it's not a lot of fun. I mean, you know, it's raising questions about whether the vaccine that's out there this year matches, the strain that is out there, and that's a concern. And, you know, too, what the flu and an outbreak like this does to the economy. More people are staying home. They're not going to work. Productivity decreases. They're not out shopping and everything else. You know, it's a perilous time for the economy as it is, and a flu outbreak of all things is not going to help.
Think of the drug makers, Chris, and all the money they're making.
Ah, good point there.
Should healthcare workers, this has been in the news, be fired for refusing a flu vaccine?
No,
Joe?
No.
Chris?
I guess not. I have a hard time with that one.
Okay, let's get our quiz answer. We have a winner, Catherine. Had the correct answer, and she was chosen at random from those who did have the correct answer. What game is updating by getting rid of an old piece and introducing a new one? It's Monopoly. Hasbro wants fans to vote daily until February 5th on their Facebook site for the piece they want to save, Battleship, obviously, and the one they want added. And then they've got a few different choices. Hasbro's president says the whole point is to make a more representative modern game. The new contender is a diamond ring, that's modern, a guitar, a toy robot, a cat, and a helicopter. Favorite piece to keep, favorite
top
one
hat.
To induct.
Top hat.
You're a top hat guy, but you won't wear it on the assembly floor.
But here's the important thing, and I know we don't have much time. I went out and tried to buy a Monopoly game on Christmas Eve. My kids wanted to play. We played Christmas Day. Try and find real Monopoly. You got Star Wars Monopoly. You got Million Dollar Monopoly. You got all this other crapola. And you can't buy real Monopoly anymore, so I don't know what the heck they're doing.
I have two classic editions at home. Chris, what piece to keep, what piece to get rid of?
Yeah, first of all, I am a Republican, so obviously I love Monopoly. race car all the way, man.
Race car
every
all
time.
The way. We have just about 20 seconds left. Packers, Niners, you're going to be watching Joe.
Packers by 10.
Chris?
Yeah, Packers by 7. They're going to take it.
All right, this is ESPN Radio. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank
and
you,
Bucky
guys.
Badger beats Illinois tomorrow.
Oh, basketball, too, right? That's out there. Joe, thank you for joining us as well. It's a Week in Review. You can hear it every Friday at this time. Two takes on the top stories and some fun stories in the news, too. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing the hour, Cynthia Schuster for handling busy phone lines. Joy Cardine is back in action Monday morning, 6 to 9. Be sure you're here. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.